Okay, so welcome everyone to our string seminar today. We're excited to have Ying Zhao giving the seminar. Just a quick logistical things. So if you have a question during the seminar, feel free to just unmute your mic and speak up and interrupt Ying so she can hear you. And then if you're not asking a question, just go ahead and keep your microphone muted to help with the sound. And then Ying said it would be good if if you feel comfortable to go ahead and show your video just so she can see some faces. And yeah, feel free to also use the chat. I'll try to monitor that if you have a question there as well. Okay, so with that said, we'll go ahead and get started. So Ying will be telling us today about PetsMap and Python's lunch. So go ahead.
Thank you, everyone, and thank you very much for giving me a chance to talk here. I hope everyone stays healthy in this crazy time. Today, I will talk about PetsMap and Python's lunch. It's based on a recent work. In this work, I will mostly just examine a couple of very simple examples to illustrate some features of interior operator reconstruction using PetsMap. I consider this as a very simple work, and I hope everyone could say understand. So feel free to ask questions to interrupt. So before we talk about operator reconstruction in the interior, let's first look at operator reconstruction in the exterior. There is a standard reconstruction protocol that's given by HKLL. What happens is, let's say if you want to reconstruct an operator somewhere in the box, let's say this is ADS, R equals zero, R equals infinity, R is a radial coordinate. And then what you can do is that you solve the bulk equations of motion, then you write this operator as a smeared operator in this time interval. And at this stage, then you can just, let's say, for example, for an operator here, you can evolve it back to t equals zero, let's say using Heisenberg time evolution. At the end, you write this operator as a smeared operator at, say, one particular time, boundary time. And it should be clear from the picture that it's the operator near boundary is you only need it's almost no smearing. The deeper you go, the more smearing you need. We want to talk about complexity of these operator reconstructions. Complexity of an operator is defined as the number of simple gates needed to apply this operator. We first define what is simple, say sigma. We normally say amount of required operators to be k local, and say just act on a couple of qubits. They don't say combine a lot of qubits at a time. And we have simple gate sets, then just how many gates do we need, the minimal number of gates we need to apply this operator. There is some layered structure about this HKLL, the complexity of HKLL reconstruction. Here, I draw Penrose diagrams of black holes, and we focus on the near horizon region. There's some, say, onion-like structure, layered structure pointed out in this paper. You see that the deeper you go, the larger the interval, this T interval, and this T is the amount of smearing you need. And clear that because, say, for example, an operator here, we eventually need to do Heisenberg time evolution to move it here. So the larger this time is, the more complex the operator is. And if this region has a near Ringer-like geometry and asymptotically ADS, then one can work out the relation between this interval T to say the location, the radial location of this operator. T is beta over 2 pi log of this A over delta A. Let me explain. It's I assume a spherically symmetric scenario, And this A is horizon radius. This delta A is, let's say, if you go out a little bit and then you again draw a sphere, it will have larger area. So to some extent, this A over delta A tells you, let's say delta A over A tells you, say, the number of degrees of freedom added as you move out. And from this relation, we can see that when this T reaches scrambling time, you are at one Planckian area outside the event horizon. From this, we should be able to see one feature is that if we really move this operator closer and closer to the horizon, this interval T will blow up. Naively, this implies that the complexity will blow up as we really say move towards this event horizon. To compare, let's say earlier, if we don't have a black hole, just empty ADS, then this interval actually never gets too large. Complexity blows up as one approaches horizon. On the other hand, we do not know that operator reconstruction beyond causal wedge in the interior is still possible, say from some earlier work of JLMS, quantum error correction, and then there's some recent work on PETS map and modular flow. The operator reconstruction, we see that HKRL implies the complexity blows up, but on the other hand, the reconstruction is still possible. And in this work, part of motivation is to see exactly say what's going on here. And before we examine, say, PETS map in detail, I want to just say, based on some earlier work, and just we can first make some guess that what the construction will be like. In recent years, there have been, say, this program of holographic complexity. I know a lot of people at PI are interested in that. The holographic complexity statement says that the complexity of a state, especially a black hole state, the complexity is given by, say, either the volume or action of a particular space-time region. You can ask, why is this true? Part of the intuition is that as the state, when you prepare the state, the minimal quantum circuit is laid in the interior of the black hole. To some extent, it's this minimal circuit somehow supports the space-time. So the circuit is stored in the space-time region in the interior. That's why at the end, the volume or the action will grow with the complexity. Because as the circuit grows, the interior grows, the space-time grows, so it's the volume eventually goes like the complexity. So once we have this intuition that the minimal circuit preparing the state is stored in the interior, then let's say if we want to apply an operator in the interior, say let's say there is a spin flying here, and we want to flip this spin. And then it's clear that what we need to do is that we need to somehow undo the circuit to come here, then flip the speed, then go out. In the rest of the talk, I will just call this circuit horizontal circuit because for the obvious reason that it grows in a space-like direction. Somehow one needs to shorten this circuit or undo this circuit. Another thing is that earlier we see that naively it looks like as you approach the horizon, the complexity blows up. But even when you are in the interior, there is still some structure here. It's like that the deeper you go, the larger the complexity is. Because for example, if we want to apply an operator here, then all I need to do is to undo this part of a horizontal circuit. But if I apply operator here, I need to do this part of the horizontal circuit. The deeper you go, the larger the complexity is. In the rest of the talk, we will see that. So this story of this undo this horizontal circuit is essentially what PETS map does. And we will estimate its complexity in some simple examples. Just to set up the notation, in the rest of this talk, I will use a PETS map. It's from the definitions from these papers. And there will be an embedding map, V of a, it's an embedding of a, from the code subspace to the CFT Hilbert space. Our operator reconstruction, the goal is to reconstruct an operator acting on this code subspace. And this code subspace is embedded into the CFT Hilbert space. With this embedding map, here's the definition of a, that's one definition of paths map. In the middle, this VWV dagger essentially is to apply W on this code subspace. And let's say the reconstruction is only on say part of system, then we trace out the other part. And then we take a ratio of this thing with sigma A. Sigma A is to some extent, it's a projection on the code subspace, but we again trace out part of the system. It's abstract at this point, but later we will look at some simple examples. We start from the simplest example, perturbed thermal field double. We represent thermal field double by say S bell pairs. I write it this way. This I goes like one to say e to the S. And let's say there is Alice site, Bob site of the black hole. And Alice at some point throws in a spin. I represent this spin is in a particular state labeled by a small a. And then she does some time evolution. The time evolution is represented by U. This is that, let's say she throws in a spin. She waits for a while until it's the spin gets completely scrambled into the black hole. And if we look at the Penrose diagram, the horizon jumps out and the part of it's the spin enters the black hole. At this point, she wants to flip the spin. And so basically earlier we represent spin by this small a goes to b, w, b, a. You can imagine in this case, w, say for example, is sigma x matrix. She just wants to flip the spin, let's say at later time. She already throws in the spin to the black hole. She wants to flip the spin. We look at how, in this case, how the code subspace is embedded into the boundary Hilbert space. H code is mapped to HA cross HB in a way like this. This is a two-dimensional code subspace. It's mapped to HA cross HB. I think for this case, one should be able to guess the answer. It's given by, say, first apply U dagger to undo the time evolution, then W, then U. And you can directly evaluate a paths map and see that this is exactly what a paths map gives. I won't go through details here. You can either find it in the paper or you can work it out yourself. It's pretty straightforward. But there is an immediate question here is what is U? We don't know U. We know W. W is sigma x. But what is U here? But recall that we don't know this U, but we do know something about the code subspace. Say earlier, we see that we know this embedding map. But it doesn't mean that we know U because at the end of the day, we need to trace out the subsystem B. So what we have is that we know the transition matrix within the code subspace. This is a spin A, this is a spin B, but then I will trace out D. I know this transition matrix, I call this MAB. Once you know this transition matrix, it still doesn't tell you what is this operator U, but it's enough to tell you what is this operator UWU dagger. If you stare at it a little bit, you see that it's given by WAB times MAB. So your knowledge of a code subspace in this case allows you to apply this operator, and this operator just act on this two-dimensional code subspace and flip the spin. Any questions so far? Okay. Now another example, pure state black hole. Let's say we assume we have initial state, I represent by capital I. And again, there is a spin throw in this by A. Under time evolution, here is the new state. I separate the state into two parts labeled by A and A bar. Later, we want to trace out A bar, so I and alpha. And again, the time evolution is represented by U. The goal is to apply sigma x. We want to flip the spin. Here is the embedding of a co-subspace to the CFT Hilbert space. It's a two-dimensional co-subspace. It's embedded. It's written as a, say, a state, a potentially complex state in the CFT Hilbert space. I call this state E sub AI. AI is the initial black hole state. A is the labels the spin. Again, let's see, what do we know about the co-subspace? We know the transition matrix element between spin A and spin B inside this co-subspace, trace out A bar. We know this matrix. Let's evaluate path map in this case. I mean, I rewrite a path map here, and we will just straightforward. We just do the evaluation, and we first want to keep the entire system. Say we don't throw away anything. The part in the middle is VW V dagger. Once I wrote this out, it looks like UWU dagger. But if you look at this carefully, it's not UWU dagger. The reason is you don't have the summation over this capital I. This capital I is a particular, say, fixed initial state. I write it this way to make the manipulation easier. Say this is E of A capital I, WAB, E of B. So it's basically just this one is to pick out the spin B, apply WAB, then give out spin A, no summation on I. On the other hand, the pi code is given by some EAI, EAI, sum over A. Again, there is a no summation on I. And in the definition of path map, I will essentially take the ratio of these two. One would like to guess the answer to be this UWU dagger, but it's different from this VWV dagger in the sense that there is a summation of this capital J, black hole initial state. But we see that we use this UWU dagger if we multiply pi code to the 1/2 on each side, we actually get VWV dagger. And then we put this -1/2 here. We see that path map tells you that the reconstruction operator here is indeed UWU dagger, as one could guess. I want to make some comment here. This VWV dagger flip the spin inside the co-subspace and give zero outside. This pi code gives one inside the co-subspace and gives zero outside. When you take the ratio, it somehow get rid of the restriction on the co-subspace, but it does not uniquely determine what's outside. If you look at, what we have earlier here from the knowledge of co-subspace, in this case, from the knowledge of a co-subspace, you do not, it does not completely determine UWU dagger. But so you have the freedom to extend you a little bit yourself outside co-subspace. But within the co-subspace, how it acts, it's uniquely determined. And here I directly use the black hole time evolution U because it's k-local. It's k-local. So at the end of the day, this is a simple operator. And then later we will talk about complexity and to see that this k-local properties of U is important. It's related to its complexity and geometric interpretations. It's well known that from the quantum error correction property, the operator reconstruction is not unique. And even if Alice loses part of her system, she can still flip the spin. Let's say if she has n qubits, if she has, in this case, if she has more than half of her qubits, say n over 2 plus 5, 6, she can still flip her spin. And the reconstruction is not unique. And we look at the case when she traces out part of the system. In order for the reconstruction to be possible, this is from earlier work of Hayden and Presco, we need that the dimension of A bar and the spin combined together is less than the dimension of A. It's the part subsystem A is what she keeps. So she needs to keep more than half of the system. And from the picture, we can look at it this way. Let's say the circuit goes up. You have the time evolution is given by U. The initial state is capital I is the initial black hole state. And then there is a spin in state A. Then under this U, there's a 5 line coming in, 5 line coming out. There's A and A bar. And we will use the properties of, under condition perfect recovery, we basically treat this U as a perfect tensor. It has the property that, let's say, if we fix this indices, the initial state I, and we have 6 indices left, 1, 2, 3, 5, 4, 6. And among these 6 indices, there is an isometry from a smaller subset to a larger subset. And in this case, just to simplify the notation, I actually divided it into 2 halves. There is an isometry from this small, from this part, these 3 lines to these 3 lines. In general, I can have, say, 2 lines here and 4 lines here. But the point is that the A subsystem is always the bigger part, such that this A, this small A, this B is embedded in this bigger subsystem, and Alice has access to this bigger subsystem. Another way to say this, I think the criterion given by this Hayden-Presco paper is that if you look at the density matrix of these 2 guys, you'll notice that if you trace out this A, you look at density matrix of these 2 guys, you'll notice that they factorize, the density matrix factorize. So this A bar subsystem knows nothing about the spin. All the knowledge of the spin is in subsystem A. This is the perfect reconstruction criterion. And in this case, if you work out the path map, you will see that the path map, again, can be written as a precursor, as say first U tilde dagger, then W, then U tilde. I won't go through the details here because I don't find it very interesting, but it's just the step basically it's in the paper and it's the same as before, just pay specific to attention of that projection. And at the end of the day, you take the ratio of something over the projection. It can be written as a form of precursor. I mean, in this talk, I will use the word precursor in a flexible way. It's a unitary, then W, then this unitary dagger. This U tilde may or may not be K-local. And in this case, if we trace out part of the system, this U tilde is actually not K-local. What is this U tilde? As we just said, in this case, there is isometry from these 3 lines to these 3 lines. And this U tilde is this isometry. And this U is a K-local. This U tilde is, let's say, when you keep some of the lines, you have isometry from this 3 line to this 3 line. There is no guarantee that this U tilde is also a K-local, and in general, it is not. Another observation here is that the more qubits you lose, the more the construction depends on the initial state I. Earlier, if we don't lose any of the qubits, we see that the reconstruction is given by UWU dagger. Note that this UWU dagger doesn't depend on the initial state I. Here, in the picture I draw, you have an isometry from three lines to three lines. So in this example, we basically lose as many qubits as we can. If we lose more qubits, the reconstruction will be impossible. And in this case, it's the U depend on I. It's basically, if you need to completely different I will give you completely different U. Your different I will give you completely different U tilde. The more qubits you lose, the more it depends on the initial state. I don't want to go through the detailed algebra. It's not easy to digest the algebra in a talk, but instead I want to show you some tensor network pictures about how this reconstruction, how this U tilde W, U tilde dagger flips the spin. Here is the illustration of this state, initial state. Initial state, there is a black hole initial state I, then spin A, U here. We apply U and we to have two parts, A and A bar. We throw away A bar and we only have access to these black lines. Here is the path map operator. Let's say this part essentially is U tilde dagger, the W, then U tilde. Again, I mean, U tilde dagger is this, is an isometry from these three lines to one, two, three, to these three lines. And then we apply W. Then again, from these three lines to these three lines. Here is, I combine these two. I put this on top of this. Let's see what we get. You see that, I want you to pay attention to this part of diagram. This basically tells you that, let's say we have start from a state. You act on this initial state, but I don't do reverse time evolution. Instead, I only have access to these three lines and I apply on U tilde dagger. What do I get? If I do U dagger here, in general, if I have all five lines, I do U and U dagger, I would have just identity. In this case, I have U and U tilde dagger. I don't get identity. What I get is instead, first of all, I get a spin out, and then I get some number of Bell pairs. So U tilde dagger in this case does not completely reverse U, but almost. The product of U and U tilde dagger in this case, it's not identity, but it's a rather simple state. You get a spin out plus some number of Bell pairs. Then I can use W to flip the spin, then come back out again. It is clear how the operator flip the spin. It's even though I only have these three lines, I can almost reverse the effect of U, flip the spin, then apply this again. Any questions so far? Okay. Once I write the reconstruction of operator in this form, U tilde W, U tilde, U tilde dagger, W, U tilde, it should be straightforward to evaluate its complexity. As we said before, W is a simple operator. So most of the complexity is in this U tilde. If we keep the entire system, then this U tilde is actually K-local. And in this example, it's actually, let's say if we throw in a spin and later we do time evolution, we throw in multiple shocks, and this U tilde is just the natural time evolution perturbed at various points, it is K-local. And the complexity of this U, a complexity of, say, if U is K-local, then complexity of an operator like this is well studied before. There is an epidemic model describing the growth of this operator. Let's say if this U is time evolution, Then before scrambling time, the complexity grows exponentially in time. After scrambling time, it grows linearly in time, is well studied. And also it has a geometric due. As we said before, that the circuit preparing, this U is the circuit preparing the state when after the spin comes in. And the circuit preparing the state is stored in the interior. So the complexity of this guy is roughly goes like the volume action from the operator to the boundary. And you notice that if the operator is here, then it matches the volume, this part. If the operator is here, then it's volume, this part. Let's check this in particular examples, SYK and JT gravity. We consider this particular operator, psi 1 of t, ut psi 1, ut dagger. And u of t is e to the minus iht, is a time evolution. There is a concept called the size of the operator. It's computed in a beautiful paper by Qi and Stryker here. The size of this operator basically counts the number of average number of fermions in this operator. It clearly grows as time grows. It starts from one, it grows as time grows. In this paper, the authors find that this number is the size of the operator as a function of time. Then how about the complexity? You can do more detailed algebra. So there is a relation between operator size and operator complexity. It's basically the size is related to the increase rate of complexity, but this rate, it may not be a constant rate. I mean, you need to take care of various factors. You can work out detail in this case. You find that actually the complexity of this operator is equals to its size. It also grows in this way. I won't go through the algebra, but I want to give you some intuition that why in this case, the size equals complexity. This is because of the tree-like structure. When you have a tree, the number of leaves at the bottom layer, at the last layer, roughly equals to the total number of leaves. And in this case, the growth of this operator, there are two regimes. The first regime is thermalization, is when this operator start from, say, the boundary of ADS2, and it goes through the throat. And during this regime, you have a tree. Then this tree is an RG-like tree. The different layers correspond to different RG steps. So in this regime, size roughly equals to complexity. And now when you enter the second regime, the near ringular regime, you have a new tree. This tree, the different layers corresponds to different ringular time step. So you have discrete ringular time step corresponding to 2 pi over beta times t. You again have a tree, but when you have a tree, the total number of leaves basically equals to the number of leaves in the last layer. That's why complexity also has this form. After scrambling time, I think these authors see the saturation of size at value n over 2. And after scrambling time, the size is constant, and one expects the complexity grows say in time in a way that say n over 2 times 2 pi over beta t. And we want to compare this with geometry. Here is a perturbed ADS2 geometry. I draw this dashed gray line here, and this line is, so let's look at a particle trajectory. This trajectory, the ADS2 boundary particle, this trajectory is the trajectory if this if this spin is not there. If this spin is not there, the boundary trajectory will be this. Then naturally the horizon is here. But after the spin comes in, it gives the boundary particle a kick. Here is the new trajectory. And what I did here is to take the intersection of this boundary trajectory with this old horizon. And I look at the geodesic distance. between this and a particular boundary time. And here it's a time dependence. We see that before scrambling time, before scrambling time, these two basically have exactly the same time dependence. So, I mean, this is only geodesic distance. This is not complexity. To get complexity, you need to times the transverse area, which in this case actually goes like S naught, because S naught is much larger than S minus S naught. Now, if you stare at this more carefully, this delta S give you one factor of beta J. And if you have S over S over minus S naught, give you another factor of beta J. So this prefactor at the end of the day is still beta J squared. And these two before scrambling time basically have exactly the same time dependence. After scrambling time, I mean, this tells you that the complexity starts to grow linearly in time. Here, you also expect the complexity start to grow linear in time after scrambling time. But here, I want to make some comment about this choice of this operator. Let's see, what does this operator do? Let's draw a will-o'-the-way patch at this time t. Inside the will-o'-the-way patch, there is a word line of this spin. When I apply this operator at time t, I flip this spin. I basically do something to this entire, this section of word line inside the will-o'-the-way patch. I flip the spin, say I change the color from red to green. But then there's a question of where is this bulk operator? I want to give some argument that why I put the operator here. First, you see that the new horizon now is no longer this line. The new horizon is here. And there is a space-time region, say, between this new horizon and old horizon. In fact, if this spin doesn't come in, this part of space-time region will not be there. The part of space-time region is there because the spin comes in. And in fact, in some earlier work, I want to argue that any gates that involving this extra coming particle is stored in the region between, say, this old horizon and this new horizon. So first of all, I want to put this thing, say, as I want to put this operator such that this somehow this entire part of space time, which is which this being is responsible for, is I want to put this location. I want the location to be deeper than this part of space time region. But then I want to argue that we actually cannot go deeper than that. Why? The input data is here that we have a say particular initial state, capital I, and capital I corresponding to a black hole with say entropy S minus one. But other than that, we don't know anything about this I. We don't even know if it has some a classical interior geometry. I mean, the exterior geometry we know is fixed. It's just a black hole geometry with a particular temperature. But interior geometry, we have no idea. We don't know if there exists a classical interior. And for example, I can even require this I to be a superposition of two wormholes with a completely different length. It may not, there may not exist a classical geometric interior, but we know it's exterior geometry, so we cannot go deeper. And in fact, if you look at our first example, two-sided black hole, imagine we start from thermal field double, then we throw in this guy. And once we go beyond this old horizon, and actually a bob from the other side can affect the spin. So, I mean, we cannot go deeper. That's why I choose this point here. Is this clear? Are there any questions? This will be the last part of my talk. Here, I mean, earlier, I mean, in this part, I we compare the complexity of this operator and the part of a geometry when you say you keep the entire system. Oh, by the way, in this part, we only compare the time dependence, say when you say throw in something, then wait for a while, do natural time evolution. And if you do more detailed calculation, you can see that if you throw in a spin and you do time evolution and you throw in multiple shocks, you go forward and backward, the complexity is indeed grows exactly as how, say, this volume or action grows. But as we discussed before, we can lose part of the system, but still we should be able to reconstruct the operator. So Alice can still flip the spin. Then what's that complexity? I think it just, even if just you just make a guess, it's a sum task, but now I have a smaller part of the system. You want to finish the same task, it will be more difficult. And in fact, the complexity gets much higher when you only have part of the system. Notice that U is K-local, as we said, because U is stored in the interior and it's a K-local circuit. But U tilde is not. U tilde is some sideways a evolution of U. Here, I call N, I use N to denote the number of qubits one loses access to. Let's look at this picture. This is an earlier definition of U tilde. I simply redraw it. This is I, the spin here, and when you go out, you have a say, this is a, this, the black line is subsystem A, the blue lines represent subsystem A bar. And U tilde is defined as an isometry from these three lines to these three lines with I fixed. If we look at the cross-sectional area of the tensor network at different instances, we see that there is a bulge here. This cross-section here has area correspond to S plus N lines because there are N lines here. N is what we lose access to. And on this part of the tensor network, there are S minus N lines. And this part of tensor network, it's again S minus N lines. This is exactly the Python's launch scenario as discussed in this paper and also something related. I mean, they didn't call it Python's launch, but something related. It's like when you have a geometry like this, it's, there is a bulge here and there is a two necks that have a smaller cross-sectional area. And in that paper, they give an estimate of, say, when you have a geometry like this, you give an estimate of the complexity, which is controlled by exponential of 1/2, the maximal area minus the smaller area. In this case, it goes like exponential in n. And actually, in my earlier discussion, in this case, if it's really n qubits, it should be 2 to the n, but I wasn't careful about is it E base or 2 base, but you see if it's N qubits, then it's 2 to the N, but if it's area, then it's a E to the N. Let's look at the circuit in more detail. I want to just, I won't say review their argument, but I want to make it say plausible. Why is it the case? In particular, I want to see that how do we apply this operator U to the dagger. What this operator does? This operator, what we want is that for any initial state I, you get a final state B of beta with U here, with a fixed with a fixed particular I. And how do we apply this operator? This is one way to apply this operator. Let's say we have initial state I, right? We have initial state I. Then I prepare n Bell pairs. I take one part of the Bell pairs and I put together with my state I. Now I have 5 lines. Then I apply U dagger on these 5 lines. U dagger is not complex. U dagger is a K-local operator, is not complex. So these 5 lines And then output, I have 5 lines. And this part, I just leave it outside and doesn't do anything with it. At this stage, if I do post the selection on this part to capital I, you will see that I actually get the target state on these qubits. So we see that if we allow projection, then applying U tilde is similar to applying U. They have similar complexity. And this complexity is not large. It has a geometric interpretation. However, if we don't allow this post selection, we can do some Grover search type thing to achieve this post selection. It's discussed in this paper by Yoshida and Kitaev, and later in this paper, there's some discussion of some protocol. Basically, what you need to do is that you need to go back and forth, and you need to run the circuit e to the n times, because the post selection is on 2n qubits, and then you need to run this circuit back and forth. Roughly e to the n times. This is e to the n because this is 1/2 of the number of qubits here. The 1/2 of the qubits that you need to do projection. And then the complexity is significantly higher. This part directly corresponding to the wormhole geometry. And you have an extra enhancement corresponding to the number of qubits you lose access to. Is this clear? Are there questions? Okay. At the beginning of the talk, I mentioned that there is some earlier work showing the complexity of HKLL reconstruction. And you see that the complexity blows up as you approach the horizon. Then it looks like it contradicts all our discussion.
Could I just ask a clarification on the last slide? Yeah, sorry. Can you just explain again what this projection is? Is that somehow you know what the initial state was or something?
Yes. So again, we mentioned earlier that the more qubits you lose, the more dependent this U tilde. The more the U tilde depends on the initial state. Mm-hmm. If you really lose as much as you can, then you need the full detailed knowledge of this initial state I. In order to apply this U tilde, you need to. So there is some. You see that you can have finished that. You want to flip the spin. You can finish the task with less qubits, but it's at a cost of higher complexity and more dependence on the initial state. If you really have the entire system, you can just directly apply your inverse. It doesn't depend on initial state I.
Right.
And the more you lose, the more dependent it is on this initial state I. In the picture I draw here, you have 3 lines here, 3 lines here. You need full detailed knowledge of this I. And in fact, what happens is, let's say, for example, if you have 4 lines here, 2 lines here, what happens is that you need to do when you do post selection, you can post select on smaller number of qubits.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, earlier we said that when you approach, say, the horizon, the complexity blows up. Then it looks like it contradicts our entire discussion during this talk. It's how come if the complexity blows up, we still are talking about the complexity of this interior operator reconstruction. Here's 2 things. We need to distinguish 2 concepts here. One is the complexity to figure out what an operator is. The other thing is, once you figure out what the operator is, how complex is it to apply this operator? There is a recent work by Boland, Feverman, and Vatsirani, and some follow-up work by Lenny. They talk about computational pseudo-randomness. The rough idea is that you can efficiently create ensembles of quantum states that are exponentially complex to distinguish from random. In particular, they talk about one particular examples is let's say we prepare ensemble by just the natural time evolution plus various perturbations at various time. But I don't tell you what are the perturbations. I also don't tell you at what time I apply these perturbations. And I hand you this ensemble. The conclusion is it's exponentially complex to distinguish this ensemble from the hard random. In particular, this implies that it's very difficult to know how the state is prepared, because I cannot distinguish it from the hard random state. On the other hand, we've seen that in our earlier discussion, in order to reconstruct the operator, we need to have some knowledge about code subspace. We need to know what this V is. But HKLL reconstruction, in HKLL reconstruction, you don't need this fine-tuned knowledge about the state. All you need to know is even if you have a black hole state, all you need to know is, let's say, mass. You can, if I hand you a boundary state, you can easily mass it, measure its mass, its temperature, and then you can apply the operator you want. You don't need any fine-tuned knowledge. But in order to apply an operator at the interior, you somehow need to know the horizontal circuit stored in the interior. You need to know fine-tuned knowledge how the state is prepared, exactly what is this state. And this part is very difficult to know. It's exponentially complex. Figuring out this horizontal circuit is the hard part. Once you figure out this horizontal circuit, you can actually just undo the horizontal circuit and apply the operator. And this is the essential difference between interior and exterior operator reconstruction. That's all I want to say. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks Ying for a nice talk. So we can just open it up for any questions from the audience. Yeah, I'll ask a question. You mentioned somewhere that you had a circuit and you said this is the Python's lunch, but I'm not sure I know exactly what that refers to. Could you just explain briefly what that phrase means? Or
Oh, I'm sorry. It's so this is from earlier work of say this paper. Python's launch, it's probably not easy to draw things here. It's you imagine a Python after having launch. So here is the shape of, can you see me?
Yeah.
Here is the shape of this Python's body. This is a head. Then there is a big bulge of his launch is stored here. Then it gets thin again. This is Python's launch. And what happens if you look at this tensor network? If you look at this cross-sectional area, this is S minus N, this is S plus N, then S minus N again. This is Python's launch. And the conclusion from this paper is that when you have a, say, geometric, if you have a tensor network that's a geometric dual, have the shape of a Python's launch, then it's if you want to ask for its complexity, the tensor network complexity is still given by, say, the area. But if you want to apply a unitary operator to achieve this, because say you only have S minus N gates here, but only have S minus N lines here, but somehow here you need to go through this S plus N thick thing. And then you need to do some, there will be some enhancement, which is proportional to, in this case, 2 to the N. It's a E to the 1/2 the maximum area minus the smaller area.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so I don't see any. So if people want to unmute their mics, we can thank the speaker again. So